Welcome to 45 North. I'm Anne Strangeamps, and we are listening to a concert. The performers are kind of unusual. Katydids, mole crickets, ground crickets, a Robinson cicada, and the jazz horn is played by renowned musician David Rothenberg. The music is from his new CD, Bug Music, which is also the title of his latest book. And Rothenberg is the guy who's carved out kind of an unusual career making music with and out of the animal world. He's played duets with whales, he's improvised with birds in the wild, and most recently he has traveled all over the world to record and play music with insects. David, welcome. Congratulations on this new project.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So with this project, you have invented a whole new kind of music, I guess, entomological jazz. Any particular inspiration?
I think this is clearly the third book in the trilogy.
First,
birds and why birds sing, and then whales and Thousand Mile Song, and now bug music. Although I would say I wouldn't imagine I would have done this when I started these projects. But once I started listening to all the rhythms and noises and thrums and buzzes of the insect world, I realized that this was a project that just had to be done.
Hmm. You're kind of moving down the scale of animals, you know, from whales to birds to now insects.
Moving up the scale to the most numerous, the most present on the planet. There's so many more insects, kinds of insects, than any other sonically active life forms. There's millions of species. There's billions of them. And they've been around longer than the other two, of course.
Yeah, and the fascinating thing, of course, is that the I guess bird songs are around us all the time. Whale songs, of course, most of us would hardly ever hear, could go a lifetime without hearing them. Insect music is around us all the time during the temperate months, but I think we just don't notice. We just kind of block it out.
Some people block it out. Some kind of enjoy it or take it in as one of the qualities of summer that makes summer memorable. But I think you're right. People don't tend to listen to it and take it that seriously and listen to all the overlapping patterns and what's really going on.
Well, what do you find interesting about it as a musician?
I think one thing is that the ways these different species respond to each other produce this kind of overlapping layers of rhythm. And the fact that such relatively simple organisms can make simple sounds repeating, and they have so many different ways they can synchronize or not synchronize, or relate to one another, and kind of all fit together in a way that probably the more complicated species don't do as much, mostly just do their own song and ignore all the others. Insects seem to listen to what other species of insects are doing.
Hmm. Their music is a lot about rhythm also, isn't it? I mean, more than, you know, whale music or bird music, which seem more melodic.
They are melodic. They have their aspects of rhythm too, but they don't have the same kind of continuous repetitive rhythm that is so much characteristic of much human music. Might it be possible that as humans developed our ideas of music, we came up with our senses of beat and pattern while surrounded by thrumming, singing insects everywhere?
That just makes so much sense, and yet I've never heard that argument before, that perhaps early humans, you know, began to create rhythm by copying what they heard, which was the rhythm of insects.
Yeah, it's purely a hypothesis, but one could investigate this, and there are certainly examples of some things I talk about in the book where you hear, say, Byaka pygmies in Africa singing along with their environment, a mixture of amphibians, insects, and birds, and you hear these human voices blending in with the soundscape. You really get a sense that yes, this is a music that makes sense. Humans have their place, but so do all these other creatures.
Uh-huh. Well, this is a special year because in some places in the U.S. on the East Coast, this is a year when the periodical cicadas will emerge, and that really only happens every 13 or every 17 years. Is that right?
Exactly. You know. Oh, where'd you get that sound? That's good.
Isn't that great? Yeah, that's from the Lang Elliott collection.
That's right. You've got their the second and third mating calls of Magicicada septendecim. And I know from spending time with Lang Elliott, he's been out there trying to capture all these precise songs for his own cicada projects.
Wait, so and, explain what you just said, though, the second and third mating calls.
I explained you just how complicated this cicada mating behavior is. And it was just 17 years ago that David Marshall and John Cooley discovered that things were much more confusing than people thought. Previously, it was just believed that, like so many creatures in the animal world, like singing spring peepers and singing crickets, the males would just make these sounds and the females would be attracted to this vast array of male singing sound. That's how the cicadas are supposed to work. They come out in the billions every 17 years. The males are making this pharaoh sound, pharaoh, pharaoh, when you hear millions of them. The end drops off. You just hear moo, and that's like, you know, the sound of the cicada disco. Everybody's going there. But then it turned out that was just the simplistic version of the story. Actually, the males make this pharaoh sound, and then there's more stuff that happens, including a female sound that nobody had noticed ever before. The females make this very quiet wing flick, like a exactly 1/3 of a second after the males stop. And then the males go on to the second and then the third sounds that you just played now. And so nobody realized insect mating behavior could be this complicated.
Oh, so that
no
it's
one had a, any idea.
So it's really a courtship.
Yes, it's a courtship, but not as simple a one as people thought before. And
right.
One of the things that comes out in this project, this book and this CD that goes with the book, is that once you hear about these stories, you then hear what previously just seemed like white noise, annoying noise of these cicadas all around you, millions of them. You hear all these 9 separate sounds that are going on, the 3 related species. Each one's making 3 different sounds. You start to hear it all right away once it's pointed out to you. And then it's like this vast natural orchestra.
Well, I want to hear one of the pieces of music you created. It's called Pharaoh, and this is from your new CD, Bug Music. Sounds. What are we listening to?
Oh, we're listening to me playing bass clarinet, and in the background accompanying me all sounds that came from some 17-year cicadas that Charles Lindsay and I collected in Lake Springfield, Illinois, and we brought them to a live concert we were doing in Champaign, Illinois. And we took them out of this little jar, and we put them there on the stage, and they're pretty much diurnal. They're active during the day, so by the evening they're kind of sleepy. And we stuck them on these microphones, and they started to sing and do things. They were very well behaved. And we brought them back to their tree an hour away the next day. No cicadas were harmed. And you hear them like they're fluttering their wings, and then they have this pharaoh sound, which then I'm sort of stretching out and making it longer and clearer. And by the time you have the recorded version, I've sort of sampled bits from that concert and then added more stuff. So that was one of the pieces constructed in the studio entirely out of 17-year cicada sounds. So you can kind of get inside this basic pharaoh sound. In the background, you hear that thrumming echo of the single pitch that millions of those pharaoh sounds becomes.
There is an astonishing video on your website of you playing in a field, and you're covered with cicadas. They're buzzing all around you. Were they drawn to you, to your playing?
There's just so many millions around that you just got out there under this tree, and this is an extraordinary amount. Usually there's not this many. This was just the right time, just the right time of day, just the right place, just the right day in the emergence. There were just so many. You couldn't – if you just got close to them, they just flew on top of you.
So,
and so – but, you know, then again, you know, Charlie didn't have so many on him. He wasn't playing. He was photographing. So maybe the music did draw them all over me, now that you mention it.
Well, the other
there were too many. There were too many that day to really keep playing, as you see, because I start running off. Like, there's just as many inside my shirt as outside.
When we did this
1 year later. Oh, well, I got me to really trust the cicada, you know. But 1 year later, we did the similar thing in Virginia as part of this film we're now making about this. And although it's not so graphic to see, the sound was a lot better. Instead of billions, maybe there were millions that day.
Mm. So the interesting – it's kind of interesting thinking about the cicadas. So there's both the sound they make, but then in some ways you could think of the 17-year silence as part of the sound, part of the music that they're making. Because they come alive, they make this sound, you know, they die. Whoops, I think that must be your phone.
No, I don't have a phone that makes that sound. Although, no, there is one. It's not mine. Yeah, what's it doing here? It's like the studio phone.
It's a random phone.
It's a phone sitting on this table.
The cicadas are calling.
Right. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. But what I'm thinking about is that this is this – when you think about it, it's I think you called it nature's slowest sonic beat when you think that it comes up every 17 years. It's kind of like too slow a beat for us really even to notice.
To even comprehend, and the very idea these cicadas are alive underground, slowly growing, waiting to come out just for a few weeks when they're going to sing, fly, mate, and die. And that all they're doing above ground is making music, and this is, you know, they've been preparing for this. It's really remarkable to imagine that this is going on. And of course, you're right, they only come out once every 17 years, but there's 19 broods of them living in different parts of the country in the eastern U.S., so you can usually find them somewhere. Somewhere like next year you can go, I think you're on Iowa or Mississippi, a small brood is coming out. In 2016, a brood comes out only on the Onondaga Indian Reservation, upstate New York.
Oh.
And then there's, 2 years ago there were 13-year cicadas in the Midwest. Last year there were some in Virginia. So you can find them if you know where to look, and this is all fairly well documented, although there are surprises. I'm sure they're going to come out some places this year. We really didn't expect them to come out.
How old are these broods?
Good question. I think in general we don't know how such a thing evolved. It doesn't happen anywhere else in the world but the United States. Some people think it might have to do with the uneven glaciation of the last ice age, that this led these concentrations to develop. Scientists think it's a lot older than that. But we really don't know. But, you know, some ecological models say just a few hundred years of intense kind of competition for resources. If there was one green area surrounded by ice, that just a few hundred years of that would make such a strange behavior start to concentrate. But that's all just theory. We don't really know. So they may be they may be tens of thousands of years old. They might be hundreds of thousands of years old. We don't know. But it's very strange kind of cyclical behavior. It's not known anywhere else in the world.
One of the things I love about reading your book and all your books is you explore the science, but you uncover even more mystery. It's like the more you discover, the more you realize just how mysterious and therefore how wonderful the natural world is. There are all these things yet to discover, things we have no idea about.
Well, thank you for enjoying these books. And to me, that's always been what the best science does. The more you find out about something, the more mysteries come up. You know, we know so much about the world, but at the same time, so little, so many questions. When you think of the millions of insect species, how few people actually pay attention to, and yet all of them have so many secrets. So many unusual things that somebody might one day find out. When I went to the conference 2 years ago of the International Society for Insect Sound and Vibration Studies, ISV, there were hundreds of scientists there. Many of them were studying species that nobody else in the room knew anything about. And
wow.
Even there, they just had a few hundred species they were looking at. So many more millions are out there.
And more yet to discover. I'm talking with jazz musician and philosopher David Rauthenberg about his new book and CD, Bug Music. His previous books include Thousand Miles Song, about playing with whales, and Why Birds Sing. We'll play a sample of that later. It's a gorgeous CD. I am Anne Strangeamps, and you are listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. ¶¶ We're talking with jazz musician and philosopher David Rothenberg about his new book and CD, Bug Music. And you are invited to join our conversation, too. What is the most beautiful or startling or dramatic animal sound you've ever heard? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us a message on our Facebook page, which is 45 North at WPR. David, why? I'm curious about how playing music with the insects and with the animals, how that's changed your hearing as a musician.
Well, the whole project totally changed sense of what kind of sounds I would consider as musical. Almost everything on this CD makes use of a kind of sound that before working on it I probably would have passed over, something too noisy, too electronic, too buzz-like, too thrumming. But the more I listened to these insects and started to understand their use of rhythm, structure, and repetition and noisiness in a musical way, I got inspired to make music using sounds like that. You just heard a little bit of this piece, Chirped to Death, which I'll tell you what it refers to in a second. But the sound you heard, the sound of a snowy tree cricket, which when it began was like, and I slowed it down and then it's going like, and singing over it is my friend Timothy Hill, who's an overtone singer. He sings more than one pitch at the same time, like Mongolian or Tibetan monks. He sings in a group called the Harmonic Choir. And he's sort of singing along with these thrumming insect sounds and building this whole kind of musical interspecies work that something you can't tell who the human is and who the bug is at that point.
Here, let's hear a little bit.
The title, sorry.
No, I was going to say let's hear a little bit more of it.
Yeah.
So is that low, slow tone? Is that a Timothy Hill singing?
One is him singing, the other is me playing the bass clarinet.
Wow.
So they're both there.
It's hard to tell which is which.
That's right. And the bass clarinet's the one that starts and stops, and he's kind of singing in there. And also the other overtones he's making naturally, whereas the different pitches of the cricket are made artificially, taking the cricket sound and pitching it down and overlapping it at different rhythmic lengths.
And now crickets are fascinating. I mean, first of all, it's one of the best known insect songs, but they are so prized in China that people keep them as pets, and which I think you actually traveled to Stockholm, didn't you, to meet a guy who's, what is he, a dealer in singing crickets?
Yeah, well, I wanted to go to China, but I couldn't quite make it there. But I knew that in Stockholm was a man named Lars Fredriksson, or otherwise known as Mr. Fung, who was an aficionado of Chinese cricket culture. He lived in China for many years. He worked as a librarian in the Chinese library in Sweden. And he always goes there to buy and sell singing crickets and cricket-raising paraphernalia. And then at one point he had 108 singing crickets living in his apartment in Stockholm that he would put forth as a kind of musical ensemble and do concerts and invite musicians to play along with him. See, I'm not the only one crazy enough to do this kind of thing.
Wait, so he would hold these concerts with 108 crickets?
And yeah, then he'd bring the crickets out. It's easier than 108 buffaloes or humans or something. Yeah.
And then musicians would come and play?
That's right. And he made several records. There's two CDs of Mr. Fung and the Chinese singing cricket ensemble.
What did the musicians say about the experience?
They at first might have been skeptical, but as they played along, they realized that here was like similar to the things that I've been doing, that here was this interesting sonic world that they could find a way into and join in with and create something special.
So is a cricket a cricket a cricket, or are there special – I mean, do some crickets – sing better than others? Are there virtuoso crickets?
Well, there's thousands of species of cricket to begin with. So each species is doing different things. But yes, among individual, within one species, some sing better than others. And this is the root of the Chinese singing cricket culture. Certain singers are considered better and people will pay more for them. And they even did things like dropping resin onto the wings of crickets to make them sing louder and lower, the pitch to go down. You know, you can use a computer to do that perhaps more easily. But to get the actual cricket to sing lower, you drop a few drops of resin on its wings and it lowers its pitch. And they would do that in China just to get a different sound out of these insects.
Well, how much does a really prized singing cricket go for?
Well, you know, the most prized crickets could be a few thousand dollars, but the most prized ones are used for fighting because money can be made. You have these matches, and these are often the same crickets that someone could buy them and decide, are you going to fight the cricket or just listen to him? It's like a choice. It's like meat or pet.
Wow, you know, that's like
what are you going
gladiatorial opera.
Exactly. You can decide what to do with your cricket. Because if it's a fighting cricket, you can make money off of him. You can have these like cricket fights and have gambling. And other people would just choose to listen.
This is
someone
a remarkable...
might buy a cricket to take him out of circulation so he doesn't have to fight anymore. Kind of humanitarian approach.
So scientifically, what's remarkable about cricket music, cricket sounds?
One thing is in the case of certain species, the way they can synchronize all together with the same rhythm without having to think so much about it. This is a kind of phenomenon of emergent order. It comes where very simple mathematical rules lead to kind of complex or synchronized behavior. This is the same thing that happens with fireflies. How come the fireflies can get all in sync? And there's a particular mathematical model that Stephen Strogatz has written about in his book Sync. Michael Greenfield figured it out as well, that, you know, crickets are hearing other crickets singing in a synchronizing species like the snowy tree cricket. All they have to do is move their own sound slightly closer to what they hear, and then it synchronizes. That's all they have to know how to do. And then they all kind of go into the same rhythm.
But there's an actual mathematical formula to it?
There is for this species and other species like that, how they synchronize. A very simple one can lead to this rhythmic behavior.
Wow.
And other species don't do that at all. This, you know, each one is a world in itself.
Wow. I'm talking with David Rothenberg. He's a jazz musician and philosopher. We're talking about his new CD and book, Bug Music. And I'm curious if you are listening, what's the most beautiful or dramatic animal or insect sound you've ever heard? Is there an insect sound that you just really love? Or have you ever tried to communicate with an animal the way David has? You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us a message on our Facebook page, which is 45 North at WPR. I'm curious about, there's another kind of more practical side to learning about insect sounds. You highlight this, it's this kind of astonishing suggestion by another composer, David Dunn, about how to use music to actually stop insects or even kill insects. Am I right?
Well, David Dunn was very interested in the fact that pine bark beetles are destroying hundreds of thousands of acres of forests in the American West. Total decimation of these forests with these tiny beetles. And David Dunn is a very exploratory listener to the natural soundscape. He's listened underwater in ponds. He has built strange microphones to record rumblings under the earth. And he said, what if I stick a microphone inside a tree where these beetles are? What am I going to hear? And he figured he'd hear them munching up the tree and killing it. Yeah, that's kind of to be expected. But what he didn't realize is they were making sounds to each other. They had this whole kind of acoustic communication where they were kind of talking to each other. And nobody realized that bark beetles made sound until he did that. And since then, now a whole scientific field is growing, study the bark beetle sounds. And then Dunn had this idea, maybe we can play some sounds to these beetles and make them stop killing the trees or do different things. And he found he was able to radically alter their behavior by playing sounds, broadcasting sounds into the trees themselves. Now, that being said, to use such a technique to actually affect what the beetles are doing on so wide a scale is nearly impossible, because you'd have to stick kind of vibrational microphones and speakers inside every tree. It would not be very cost effective. But then again, nobody has any idea what to do about this infestation, so why not investigate this acoustic communication, see where it might lead.
Wow. And there's another one I wanted to ask you about. This is here, I'll play it. This is insect drummers, and it's the sound of the water boatman, which is one of it's amazing for a lot of reasons, but let's listen first.
Yes, the lesser water boatman, a tiny water beetle. You know, you'd think that the bigger the animal, the louder a sound it's capable of making, and usually that is the way it works. But this tiny, half-centimeter-long underwater bug makes a sound almost as loud as a whale or a rock concert, like 80, 90 decibels or so. And he makes it by vibrating his penis underwater. And this was discovered by a guy named James Windmill in Scotland. And Dr. Windmill, he dipped his underwater microphone, his hydrophone, into the pond and heard this. He said, "Something must be wrong with our equipment. There's nothing that could make that loud a sound here." So they couldn't believe it when they figured out it was this tiny beetle.
He's making a sound from a body part that for everybody else on Earth is silent. Why does it do
this? Well, I don't know. Is that really true? Is it silent in all species?
You probably know better than I would.
To investigate that. There's some sort of study to be done there.
Your next
book. So this is an amazing one of another amazing strange insect sounds that, why did such a thing possibly evolve? Where does it come from? It's just pretty crazy. And so the whole story and the sound is immediately inspiring to so many possible directions. And
but do we know why it does this?
Well, it's doing it to attract attention, like so many male creatures are doing. But why does it need to do it in this way? It's one of those strangely extreme things that has evolved in nature. And the explanation for that is often thought to be a sexual selection, that the females are just sort of attracted to this extreme behavior. And it goes more and more and more, generation after generation, something that Darwin pioneered the explanation of in Descent of Man. This could explain peacock's tails, excessive bird songs, possibly humpback whale songs, excessive plumage and, birds of paradise, things like that. But, it explains how it might have evolved, but it doesn't explain the aesthetic nature of such things. The fact that they're so extreme and beautiful and crazy, is often – that aspect of it seems to be overlooked by science in some ways.
Right. We've got Earl on the line calling from Sussex, who maybe has an example of an animal sound that's amazing or that he loves. Hi, Earl.
Hi there. Yes. If we had five Afghan hounds, and before they would retire in the evening – they would howl into just a chorus. It was just beautiful, kind of like wolf sounds or coyote sounds, but they seemed to they howl in harmony. It was really kind of made chills up your back to hear them. And then after they would get through it, they would just relax and they would go to sleep. But it was really beautiful.
These were Afghan hounds?
Yes, Afghan hounds.
And do you think their howl sounded different from... I don't know. My husband used to have beagles, which howled horribly. I'm not sure. It was beautiful. Do you think Afghan hounds howl differently than other kinds of dogs?
Well, I just knew that they were, like, when they were all howling together, they had a harmony, and it was beautiful, I thought, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, David, it doesn't have to be beautiful to you. It has to be beautiful to them. And certainly different... species of dog howl differently. Different individuals howl differently, but they all, are not so many generations away removed from wolves. And this howling is used in a different way than the songs we're talking about here, I think, to build some kind of unity among the pack. They're all kind of showing their solidarity and, reminding everyone, here we are. We're part of this. We are the group.
Is there something?
The harmony.
Is there something interesting that's happening musically? The way Earl was talking about the way harmonics build between the voices of hounds. I think the same thing happens with wolves, doesn't it?
I think it's interesting. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It isn't one of the species I've really investigated.
Maybe really? I'm surprised project. You haven't gone and played with wolves?
Probably because I guess, you know, one musician who got me interested in all this, Paul Winter, was famous playing with wolves. So I figured, let's let him have the wolves. I'll play with some other creatures.
There are others to go around.
Right. Yeah. Wolves are hard to find, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know in Wisconsin, but, you know, coyotes are easier to find.
Yeah, I know. There are some living about a couple blocks from me. We've got Lisa calling from Sheboygan next. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Did you have an animal or bird sound?
Well, I thought it was really interesting that about 10 years ago, people at the Horicon Marsh, they wanted some music that incorporated all of the birds in the marsh throughout a number of music beds that they were going to use for radio public service announcements. So they asked me to listen to the CD of all the bird songs from the marsh, and I came up with music and wove some of the bird songs in. But the one that stood out the most to me was a red-eyed vireo, and it just kind of, it was uncanny the way it fit into a song I had already written, so I felt kind of lazy that I had gone and taken something I'd already done, but I actually shifted the pitch to make it longer, and I thought it was interesting that when your guest said that he had done that with some of the insect sounds.
Yeah.
Did you find that your own song that you composed, did it get better when vireos were added to the mix?
Oh, yeah, sure. Added what was missing, I think.
Yeah, I think there should be many more human musicians doing this kind of thing, which is something I was talking about with Paul Winter when I interviewed him for my whale book, that, you know, I was pointing out how many composers and pop musicians did things with whales once Humpback Whale Song was discovered in the 1960s. He said, yeah, maybe there was 10 or 20, but there should have been hundreds. There should have been thousands. All human musicians should be thinking about this. It should be part of everyone's musical education. And I think he's right about that.
Of course, it's not as though composers haven't done this before. I mean, speaking of bird sounds, there's a Mozart piece who's famously inspired by the song of a starling he used to hear.
Yeah, that's right. He bought that starling when he heard it whistling a piece that he had just composed a few days before. He couldn't imagine the bird had heard it, so he wanted to find out more. There's that, and there's, you know, Béla Bartók wrote piano pieces with cricket sounds embedded. Hmm. With insects, it is perhaps less known, but I did put on my website for this book, bugmusicbook.com, I put a list of my favorite 25 or so pieces of human music I felt were inspired by insects, so you can listen to those there.
We're talking with David Rothenberg. He's the author of the new CD and book Bug Music, and you can join the conversation. Maybe you've tried to communicate with an animal or have a beautiful or startling animal sound you'd like to share with us. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And we have an email from a listener, Laura, who says, every day for a few months when I went outside my apartment, I would whistle a few simple tunes to the starlings in the tree nearby. And one day when I was packing up to move to a new city, I was alone on my porch when a few of the starlings flew into the tree and were singing to me in the exact tunes that I had been teaching them for months. Such amazing and beautiful animals. Wow. Yet we haven't talked, David, about the ways in which, I mean, have you played and had animals answer you? Yes, I know you
absolutely
have.
Absolutely. You know, there's three of the tracks on this CD are live with insects. And I would say, you know, two of them are live with cicadas, and one of them is Timothy Hill doing overtone singing with a night chorus at a farm full of crickets and katydids. And although insects, you know, are part of this kind of vast orchestral machine where you kind of can tap into that and you can affect them in kind of very subtle ways where the whole rhythm and sound changes, with more individualistically variable creatures like humpback whales and some birds, there's a really definite reaction that sometimes happens.
Wow. So did the insects actually responded to you?
I think they respond in kind of vague ways. When a sound gets louder, they might join in. If you imitate, you know, periodic cicada sounds, like the other species makes kind of synchronized washes of noise, like waves going shh. If you start to make that sound, they will certainly join in with that. And they can also tap into, they hear bits of that sound if you play something different but related. They kind of hear, I think, in a more very particularly keyed but also more open way. They're going to hear that fluctuating hiss in sounds that might have other things in it as well.
Well, you've done a lot of this with birds. Also, there's a track on your Why Birds Sing CD that I really love. Here, I think we've got it queued up. I'll let you tell us what this is. You were really going back and forth there. What was happening?
Yes, well, this piece, you've got the flutist Michael Pestel and myself playing clarinet along with one bird who is a superb lyrebird. That's a species. And this is this famous lyrebird that lives in this open-air zoo in Healesville, Australia, near Melbourne. This is the bird filmed by David Attenborough in the most popular of all clips from all David Attenborough programs. You know, there was a survey done last year, and people picked by far, the lyrebird who imitates camera clicks and chainsaws and all these sounds. And this is this one bird that lives in this giant open-air zoo. It doesn't have much else to do but sing along with human sounds and tourists. And lyrebirds, as I write in that book, they have the most complex of all bird songs. It takes them 6 years to learn to sing it. And it's a strange mixture of noises and fragments of other bird species songs mixed together in different orders as it feels like. It kind of cuts and pastes them together in different ways. He's a complete cut and paste sampling remix artist, the superb lyrebird is. And Michael and I were just we wanted to play along with him. There were some tourists there, and they just sort of saw us and said, oh, this must be what you have to do. You have to feed these birds music in addition to food. Nice idea. And so that's one of the very fun examples of the things you can do with the most virtuosic of our bird musician friends.
But I'm curious about the experience as a musician playing with an animal, with a bird like this, because, you know, when you're a jazz musician, and jazz musicians famously improvise together, and it's a kind of communication. I mean, I've talked with jazz musicians who talk about kind of getting in a zone where it feels like their mind and the minds of their fellow musicians are, it's a conversation. It feels like something, some connection is really building between them, a wordless kind of conversation they're having. Is that how it feels when you're playing with a bird or with another animal?
Well, that's right. And this is why, you know, a jazz musician or any kind of open-minded musician can get together with people from a different culture. I could sit down with someone from Mongolia or New Guinea and start playing music with them, even if we might not share the same spoken language. Music has this wonderful way to communicate across cultural lines. So it's just a bit of an extension to say maybe it can communicate across species lines as well. You know, birds need music. Bugs need music. So do people. We need music so much. We're not quite sure why. We don't always know what it means. It's hard to translate its meaning into any other form. So why not make music with whoever is there making sound, human or not human?
We've got Bridget on the line from Lake Tomahawk with a story. Hi, Bridget.
Hey, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good, good. So I just wanted to share kind of a funny story. My boyfriend's got a cabin up in the Lake Tomahawk area, and it's always kind of fun to go to bed at night and have the windows open and listen to the whippoorwills. So we both just seem to enjoy the sound of the whippoorwills. So when we're in Madison, sometimes if we're like out and about and kind of separated, like in a crowd or something like that, if one of us wants to find each other, we'll just start making a whippoorwill call. Instead of yelling or, hey, Randy, we'll just start making the call, and then you kind of start looking around to see where that call's coming from, and then you can find that person. So just wanted to share another bird story with you.
Well, you've learned exactly how many animal species use sound so that male and female pairs can find each other in dense habitat. That's one of the ways in which duetting sound evolves in birds. And, of course, you picked the whippoorwill, which is a bird that strangely sounds like an insect.
It does?
Yeah, it sounds like a cricket. It's making these repeating sounds. It doesn't have this more complex, melodic, shaped beginning, middle, and end kind of phrases. It's much more like an insect use of sound. I don't know how many whippoorwills one hears singing all at once, whether there's lots of them or whether it's always one or two.
Wow. I want to go next to Bill's on the line. I think he's been waiting a while. Bill from Nina. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'm fascinated by this. You had a book, an author on the show, or a similar show, about a year ago with a book called Fast Sing, Mice Giggle, if I haven't got it backward. And I was wondering if animals communicate by sight, as do the birds of paradise, and by sound as well. And we communicate also in some ways through pheromones, and other animals communicate through electromagnetic waves. Do you see any other frontier we haven't cracked yet that's a function of, what we don't have the instruments to listen to yet?
Well, probably the most mysterious and strange form of animal communication is what squid and cuttlefish do.
What do they
using? They use color sensitive cells on their bodies called chromatophores. They change their color and even the shape, their whole shape at will. They change their shape and color, and sometimes they can be camouflaged. Sometimes they can put on bright light show displays in their skin, and you see them together. They're changing their very shape and form as they communicate with each other, which is really astonishing. We have no idea how they even do this. They can make one side of their body camouflaged and the other put on some stripes or put on some spots or some brightly pulsing displays. And we have no idea what's really going on. We've been able to identify what the patterns are. We're not quite sure why they're used in which context. Sometimes it seems practical. They're trying to make their prey confused. Sometimes they want to hide, but sometimes they're just putting on these displays with each other. It's as if they're talking by changing the patterns and colors and shapes on their skin.
I think maybe there's a sound and light show in your future. We're talking with David Rothenberg about his new book and CD, Bug Music. I'm Ann Strange-Shamps, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with David Rothenberg, jazz musician and philosopher, about insect music. And we've got Margaret on the line from Elgin, Illinois. Sorry, hi, Margaret. Remind me, how do you say Elgin or Elgin?
Elgin.
Thank you. Anyway, yes, you called.
Thank you for this program. It is amazing. I wanted to share how much I do love the cricket and cicada sound. And years ago in Montana, they saved my sanity one winter because they lived under the carpet in the laundry in the hallway. And they were so special because you heard this noise in 40 below. So we've always saved them. We carry them outside our house if one happens to get in. And I just wanted to say thank you to your guest for treasuring this so much.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
Well, thanks. Yeah, there's many Chinese and Japanese poems about this very fact that crickets crawl into the house when it starts to get cold. They know it's warmer there, and they survive only inside the human world over the winter. And a lot of poets in the Far East have written about this and written about the cricket by the hearth, the cricket inside the house as this kind of comforting sound.
Mm. Now, David, we've talked a lot about the different reasons, courtship or community building, that animals make sound. We haven't actually really talked about whether they make sound simply for joy or simply because they think it's beautiful. Do you think they do?
Oh, absolutely. Not so simply and maybe more complicatedly that in addition or maybe in the very essence of these functional reasons for this phenomenon to evolve is the sense that it's beautiful, that it's attractive. And when, you know, if that sounds unscientific, you should know that when scientists are investigating what goes on in the brains of birds as they're singing or as they're listening to songs, they know very well the singers and the listeners are addicted to singing. You know, dopamine is released. They enjoy it. They love it. They have to do it. And you can't say that's unscientific or subjective or humanly biased. It's really part of the whole phenomenon as much as any other reason. And surely, you know, nature as evolution is motivated by desire. It's motivated by exploration of possibilities. You know, these crazy things have evolved, you know, vibrating underwater beetle penises making huge amounts of noise. You know, it didn't have to be that way. If you're going to engineer a world where all living forms were perfect little machines, you wouldn't get all this wild, crazy stuff. Evolution is relentlessly creative and experimental. And produces all kinds of things nobody would ever design, nobody would ever expect. And that's one of the wonderful things about it. And listening to these beautiful sounds made by whatever creatures, you know, is one way to tap into this remarkable and beautiful part of the natural world.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
We've been talking with jazz musician and philosopher David Rothenberg about his new book and CD, Bug Music. Now, before we go, I want to let you know that in about 3 weeks, we'll be launching our radio book club, 45 North Reads. And our first book will be Red Moon. It's a new novel about to hit the stores by Benjamin Percy, who lived in Wisconsin for years and is currently writer in residence at St. Olaf. It's a literary horror novel. And Ben will be joining us on May 10th for an on-air book club. But to whet our appetites, he sent us this message about his new novel.
When I sat down to write Red Moon, I thought about some of my favorite horror stories, the most lasting horror stories, and the way that they're very much connected to cultural unease. The way that Dracula is born out of Victorian prudishness, the way that Frankenstein is so connected to the Industrial Revolution, the way that the Red Scare gave rise to invasion of the body snatchers. So when I sat down to write this supernatural thriller, I asked myself, what do we fear now? And what we fear now, most of all, seems to be disease and terrorism. And so I braided those two together. It's a reinvention of the werewolf myth. In this case, roughly 10% of the population is infected, and so these people are forced to be on a public registry, similar to a sex offenders registry. They are prevented from holding certain jobs, and they have to take an emotionally deadening prescription drug called Vulpex. So, of course, there is resistance. I hope that people recognize this as not only a horror story that might keep you up late at night. But also, I was really trying to go for a political allegory at the heart of it. I hope that people are able to read it in an Orwellian sort of way. I think that the werewolf myth is one that everyone can connect to because everyone has gone over the edge. And later on, maybe after they wake up the next morning, come to regret their behavior. And I was trying to tap into that, tap into the fact that we're all hairy on the inside.
Benjamin Percy's novel Red Moon is our first selection for 45 North Reads, our new radio book club. The book will be in bookstores in May, and Ben will join us on May 10th. And in the meantime, you can read all about it on our Facebook page. That's 45 North at WPR. Today's show is produced by Marika Suval, Rhonda Fanning, technical direction from Dave Potras and Joe Hartke. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and we'll see you again next Friday on 45 North.